Chapter 26, our parsha today, begins by telling us when you are in the land and when you feel secure, you are to bring tithes to the priests. And in fact, there is a rotation of tithes. Every year, your tithes don't go to the same place, at least back at during the first temple period, you were to bring your tithes to the Kohen. Sometimes it would go to the poor. Other times, you'd eat it, and you'd go to Jerusalem, throw a party, and have a feast. Kind of interesting, huh? You were to put your first fruits in a basket and go to the place where the Lord your God would choose to establish his name. Verse 2, as we heard David read beautifully earlier. This became identified with Jerusalem throughout the centuries. Jerusalem has and remains for us the spiritual center of the earth, physically, militarily, economically, politically, spiritually. Jerusalem is at the heart of every issue. And this is where one would put their tithe in a basket and take it to the place where God would put his name, his identity, his character. And the priest would take the basket and set it down at the altar, and then you would recite a speech. It's the only time in the Torah where people that aren't priests or Levites or elders or judges are actually given a speech to recite. The liturgy that we have, that we recite in prayer, has developed since the time of Moses, beginning with David, for instance. But here is the only speech in the Torah that someone who wasn't in one of those other positions was to recite. Interestingly, when they brought their tithe, you were to say, "My father was a fugitive Aramean. He went down to Egypt." By the way, referring to Jacob. There was another translation, if you remember from the Passover Haggadah, that translates it, "An Aramean killed my father." This one was, "My father was a fugitive Aramean." And it plays on the relationship between Jacob and Laban from the book of Genesis. So you might have a translation, actually, that reads it the other way around. This translation says, "My father was a fugitive Aramean. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers, and he sojourned there." Just a temporary stay. "But there he became great and very populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us and imposed heavy labor on us. And we cried to the Lord." I love it. The psalm says, "I love the Lord because he hears my cry, turning his ear to me." God heard the cry of his people in Egypt under that harsh, bitter treatment. "And the God of our fathers, the Lord, heard our plea," continuing, "and saw our plight, our misery, our oppression. And the Lord freed us from Egypt with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, with awesome power, and by signs and wonders. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Wherefore now I bring the first fruits of the soil, which you, O Lord, have given me. And there you will bow and worship the Lord, and you will rejoice in there with the Levite and the alien, the stranger, in all the bounty that the Lord has given to you and your household. When you bring your tithe, according to Torah, one was to remember the struggle and the journey that Israel had in Egypt. I've never heard anyone do that when they brought a gift up to the tzedakah box. We're not bringing baskets of vegetables and fruit, figs and pomegranates. Although I have seen some of you in the last couple of months, as your garden has sprouted, exchanging veggies. That's been so great to watch. But there was this idea of memory, of remembering what had happened. Remember how your ancestors were oppressed by Egypt, although we became a mighty, mighty nation in Egypt, we experienced the original anti-Semite, Pharaoh, who attempted the first genocide of the Jewish people. We remember that even there, God kept his promises and caused Israel to grow. It's so fascinating that in Scripture, growth and transformation most often happens in exile. But that's a separate sermon. That's the one I thought about doing. But I'll just let you play with that. But there was this idea, we remembered the pain. We remembered the past. Every time they brought their first fruits, their tithe, to the Levite, they would rehearse the memory and identify with what had come in the past. Israel lives with the past. It's what the entire Passover Seder is. It's one great big long recitation of what happened in Egypt and how God acted to rescue and redeem his people. Salvation, rescue, redemption happened there when Israel cried out to God. And every time we bring our tithes, we rehearse that past. We rehearse the pain. But note that just a couple chapters earlier, in last week's Torah portion, there was one little line that sets all this in beautiful context. It said, "Do not hate an Egyptian in your heart," and included an Edomite, who were the descendants of Esau. They were like cousins of Israel, who, by the way, weren't very nice ever to Israel, the Edomites. But in that same verse, it said, "You are also not to hate the Egyptians in your heart. You were strangers in their country." And I want to go, "But Moses, what do you mean strangers? You mean slaves in their country, right? That's what it really means, right?" But Moses didn't put it that way. He said, "You were strangers, you were aliens in their country." So you are not permitted to walk in anger. You are not permitted to walk in hate against the Egyptians. Has that ever soaked in your life, in the life of the people Israel, in the lives of the people in our world? You recite it every time they would come to Jerusalem to bring the first fruits of their crops, living with the memory. Memory is like air to Jews. It's a quote from Elie Wiesel. Memory is like air. Israel lives on memory. We live with the memory of the past, but that does not mean we live in the past. There is a vast gulf of difference between the two. You live with the memory of the past, but you cannot hate the Egyptians in your heart, meaning you cannot live in the past. You cannot continue to live in that experience. In our society, in our country, we are dealing with people that not only live with their memory, but they live with their hate, they live with their pain, they live with their rage. And people seem to relish the response to the opportunity to nurse a grudge, to identify so strongly with someone else's pain that they are willing to act out in malice and hate and violence. Undoubtedly, you know the experiences yet again. What's new, right? Shootings involving police officers, bullets flying one way or the other, in Charlotte this week. Which have led to repeated demonstrations for days now. Subsequently, people shot and killed because they live not with a memory of pain, but they live in the pain. And the pain is only it's our society, it's our nation, it's our culture, it's driving us to destroy each other. Martin Luther King said, "Hate does not drive out hate. Only love can do that." Are demonstrations okay? Is marching in the streets, waving signs, shutting down interstates? Literally, so many people marching, traffic couldn't move down the interstate through Charlotte. Does hate drive out hate? Does violence drive out violence? He continued, "No, hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence. in Jewish literature, it's expressed how one sin always pulls another one with it. There's always sin doesn't come in singles. Sin comes in a multi-pack, the Costco version. Sin doesn't come at a convenience store where you just buy one at a time. And I guess we can watch it in our lives and in the lives of those we love, that when we do something wrong, something else will be coming along, and that's where we need to step up and identify and admit that we have sinned, admit we're wrong, so we can stop the train right there. But there's this recognition that one evil simply is the locomotive that drives or pulls other evils along behind it. So hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence. I found another quote by a 20th century black writer named James Baldwin. He made a statement that one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense that once the hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain. One of the reasons people hold on to their hate so stubbornly is that they sense once the hate is gone, they will have to deal with pain. In other words, not just living with the memory of pain, like Moses told Israel to do regarding Egypt, not just living with the memory of pain, but living in the pain. Like I said, there's a vast difference. Violence, this individual was asserting, is driven by fear. Hate, violence, malice, greed is driven by fear. It's the fear of what will happen to me if I don't keep my arms up, proverbially, so to speak. What will happen to me if I expose myself? What will happen to me if I don't fight? What will happen to me if I don't hate? I can't deal with what lies beneath. I can't deal with the memory of the pain that I live in. So I act out. I speak out. I'm brash. I have bravado. I manipulate and control my world in such a way as to protect myself, because I don't want to acknowledge the pain that I live in. Of course, Moses said, you don't have to, in fact, you are not to live in the pain. You live with the memory, but you do not live in the pain. As Moses said, you are not to abhor, you are not to hate the Egyptians, because they were your landlords. They were your guardians. They provided a place for you to live in their country, as traumatic and painful and bitter as it was. But Moses has the chutzpah to push us to sever that. In fact, Rav Shaul goes so far as to say, do not let the sun go down on your wrath. By the way, when does a day end in Jewish, on the Jewish calendar, when does a day end? That's sundown. Evening and the morning were the first day. Evening and the morning were the second day. In other words, the day starts at evening. When the sun goes down, it starts a new day. That's why on our high holy days, we have two services, first in the evening and then in the day. Rav Shaul said, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. And that's often preached as don't go to bed angry, which is really a good message. I think that's a great application. Don't go to bed angry. But I think really what he is getting at from a biblical Jewish worldview is that don't let the sun go down. In other words, don't let a new day start before you deal with your issues. That's really what it means. It doesn't necessarily mean don't go to bed angry. That's a nice application. But don't carry your anger with you more than a day. Don't start a new day before dealing with your pain. Nations are in an uproar, the psalmist says. The nations are in an uproar. In Leviticus chapter 19, we are told how to deal, or how to prevent, rather, hate from growing. Verse 17, Leviticus 19, you should not hate your brother in your heart. You should not hate your brother in your heart. The next verse is that famous one that says, instead, love your neighbor as yourself. But leading up to that, it tells us such things as, do not show favor to the poor or deference to the rich. Judging unfairly, not being impartial in judgment, leads to hating your brother. That's verse 15. Verse 16, it says, do not deal basely. Do not act contemptuously toward your brother. We've now upped the ante from impartial judgment against your brother to dealing perversely with your brother. Verse 17, do not hate your brother in your heart. Verse 18, do not take vengeance or bear a grudge. You notice, I see here in these five verses in Leviticus 19 a progression. Each verse intensifies the trauma. At the end, it's talking about don't hate your brother, and then it says don't bear a grudge. What did it say? Don't take vengeance. Don't take vengeance on your brother. Taking vengeance comes from hating your brother, which comes from acting callously towards your brother, which comes from impartial judgment against your brother. It is a progression. Where will we stop that choo-choo train of evil that brings one sin with another one and another one? And finally, we're taking vengeance against one another because we have failed to deal with the pain that we have in our life. Colossians chapter 3, which is somewhere in here. Colossians 3, verse 13. Bear with one another. Forgive one another. If anyone has a grievance against another, you should pardon others just as Messiah pardoned you. And above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfect harmony. Let the shalom of Messiah rule in your hearts, because it is to this shalom, it is to this letting the peace of Messiah penetrate the pain, verse 15, it is to this shalom that you were surely called in one body. And also be thankful. You don't see protesters and mobsters with statements of thanksgiving, do you? I know, it sounds so crazy. Rabbi Paul's solution, among others, was to walk in thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, the peace of Messiah, forgiving one another, bearing with one another, are facets to begin to deal with those interpersonal relationships, to deal with the pain that is carried in the heart. You are not to abhor and hate the Egyptians, despite what they did to you. But yet you remember the experience. You remember, but you don't live in it. Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of the British Empire. Is it still an empire? The British Commonwealth said, to be free, you have to let go of hate. He continued with listing things that nip that in the bud. He said, resentment, rage, humiliation, the desire to restore honor by inflicting injury on your persecutors, to one-up the other, to restore some sort of honor by inflicting injury on others. He said, these are conditions of a profound lack of freedom. Resentment, rage, humiliation, a sense of justice, the desire to restore honor by inflicting injury on your former persecutors, are all conditions that reflect a lack of freedom. We say we're the land of the free and the home of the brave. But according to the English guy, the English rabbi, talking in a different context, pointed out that those kinds of qualities that result from acting out of our pain are things that destroy our freedom. To be free, you have to let go of hate. We should define ourselves by God's love instead of defining ourselves by hate. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1. So what do we do? Some of the things we do is what Rav Shaul suggested in Colossians. Something else is we define ourselves by love and not by these other things that we act out of because it's how we're thinking of ourselves. Ephesians 5 says, be imitators of God as dearly loved children. And walk in love, just as Messiah also loved us and gave himself up for us as an offering and sacrifice to God for a sweet aroma. Think Leviticus sacrifices. Yeshua is the pleasing, sweet aroma sacrifice to the Most High. But note in those two verses, it used the idea of love three times, but in three different ways. Be imitators of God as dearly loved children. That means, is love natural to us? Heck no. We grow as dearly loved children as we are imitators of God. Be imitators as dearly loved children. Another problem with our society is that they don't understand what real love is. And that's a different message too. Simply like I said last week about faith is not a thing you possess. Faith is something you do. The same thing with love. Love is not something you possess. It is something you do for someone else. The world is so screwy on that issue. I actually heard, I don't have time for this, but this is good. I actually heard on NPR, they were talking about young people. The millennials, which are like the older teenagers and 20-somethings, and their perspective of relationships and love. And the question was asked, which is more important, to give love or receive love? And you really don't want to know what they said, because you already know what they said. They interviewed several different ones. I don't know who did this interview. I can't source it. The best I could do is look it up. But the responses generally came along, well, you know, it's nice to do things for people, but really in the end, I just want to be loved. I just want to get, that relationship. They'd give some sort of preliminary lip service to a statement of doing love, but then it was like, I just want it. Remember, love is not an it. It is not a thing you possess. It is something you do. That's why I tell couples in strife in their marriage, and luckily no one here in the room, so no one has to feel awkward. How do you rebound that? How do you get back? How do you deal with the issues? You stop expecting to get, and you start doing to the other person. Love is not something you receive. It is something you do. Emotions follow actions. Do love, and then you'll feel like it. You'll feel loved. Emotions, according to Scripture, follow actions. If you wait to feel the emotion, it either won't last, isn't genuine, or won't produce the actions that God requires. Okay, that was a tangent. Imitate God as dearly loved children and walk in love. I'm back in Ephesians. and walk in love, learn to love by imitating God, to becoming dearly loved children, and then walk in it. That's walking. It's halakha, would be the Hebrew word that Rabbi Paul had in mind, to walk, to live in it, to do it. That's why I said love is something you do. Walk in love, just as Messiah also loved us. Like I shared 3 weeks ago or so about how Torah explains that Messiah loved us before we loved him, right there in the Tanakh. Finally, this idea about Messiah loving us and giving himself up for us leads me to my final thought in dealing that I wish our society would hear in dealing with the pain that they choose to live in and not just live with the memory. And that is the idea of identifying with the other. Did you know, speaking of Egypt, I'll bring in Egypt again, in Isaiah, did you know that at one point Isaiah talks about the time will come when Egypt will be wrapped into Israel? Zechariah mentions it too, Zechariah 14. In the Isaiah version of the story, God even says, Egypt is my people, which is somewhat revolutionary because almost every single time Scripture refers to God's people, it's always Israel. And that's even in the New Covenant Scriptures. But there, Isaiah calls Egypt, God, in the words of God, my people, my people. We've moved from a history of pain in Egypt, living with the memory of that, to an understanding that Egypt is now us. With us, Egypt is enveloped. Romans language would be grafted in. Egypt is enveloped into the people of Israel. How can you but identify then? Psalm 35, David says, I will pray for the person who persecutes me. I will even mourn for them when they are sick. I'll pray for them when they are sick, and I will mourn for them like someone mourns for their mother or their brother. In other words, David's saying, my enemy should be as dear to me as my own family. But is that our culture that we're dealing with? We learn to identify with the other. One last passage of Scripture. Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. Philippians 2, 3. Do nothing out of selfishness or conceit, but with humility consider others more important than yourself. Looking out not only for your own interest, but also for the interest of others. We're not teaching self-degradation. We're not teaching low self-esteem. We're not teaching a false humility, which, by the way, that's a very real concept. We're teaching true humility, which is actually a strong self-identity, but is with an extended hand to others, an identification with others, looking out not only for what I want, but what others want also. And then it gives the classic example. Yeshua, though existing in the form of God, did not consider being equal to God something to be grasped. But he emptied himself, taking the form of a slave. He humbled himself, becoming obedient to the point of death, even on a cross. For this reason, God highly exalted him and gave him the name that is above every name, that is, the name of the Almighty, that at that name every knee will bow, every tongue in heaven and earth and under the earth, this is quoting Isaiah actually, will profess that Yeshua the Messiah is Lord to the glory of God the Father. It uses Yeshua as the greatest picture of identification. How can we identify with others? How can we learn to love? How can we learn to bear with one another? How can we learn to not live in the pain? How can we learn to not have our freedom destroyed by resentment and rage and malice? It's learning to identify with others the way Yeshua identifies with us. We were the flagrant rebellious ones. We were the ones walking out of the land to exile, as the Torah portion points out, in disobedience. But in that is exactly the place, in our exile, in our pain, Messiah identified with us. And it sounds like a tall order, but Rav Shaul is telling us that's exactly how we should identify with each other. Unity is found in that mutual identification, mutual serving, forgiving each other, bearing with each other, being compassionate with each other, just as Messiah has forgiven us. That is the prescription for not only North Carolina this week, that's the prescription for our lives. That's the prescription for when the hate comes to Kentucky. What will we do? How will we respond? How do we respond if we already live there with a family member, with a coworker that acts in this way? I pray that God would give us strength to know the difference between living with the memory of what we've been rescued from, but not living with the trauma of being rescued. Not living in our pain, because that's where Messiah steps in and identifies with us.